The Supreme Court moves on a challenge to the Trump administration's efforts to terminate the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. We'll have details today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. The High Court pushes back on a DACA rollback, but leaves open many questions about the future of the program that protects hundreds of thousands of young people from deportation. We'll take a closer look. Also, understanding Juneteenth, a firsthand reflection on its importance. Plus, the first FDA-approved video game, a high-tech prescription to help young people with attention deficit challenges. We'll have those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 18th day of June 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us on a day of breaking news affecting the lives of an estimated 643,000 people in the U.S. who came here as children but who were allowed to stay in the country under an Obama-era administrative rule called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. As of 2020, the Migration Policy Institute estimates there are some 106,000 people in Texas who are DACA recipients. And in a moment, we'll be getting reaction to the Supreme Court's decision from one of them. But first, we're going to explore the decision itself and its practical implications, because it is a complex ruling. Though this much seems clear, the High Court today dealt a blow to the Trump administration's efforts to, as the administration put it, immediately terminate the program as it had planned to. In a majority opinion written by Chief Justice John Roberts, joined by the court's four most liberal members. But what does this ruling actually mean for DACA recipients and for the program? Well, first, to help us take apart what the decision says and what it does not, we are joined by Denise Gilman, who directs the Immigration Clinic at the University of Texas Law School. Professor Gilman, welcome back to the Texas Standard. We appreciate you joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin with some background here. I seem to recall the Attorney General of Texas had been among those pushing for termination of this program. For the time being, at least, it seems to me that's not going to happen.
That's right. So everybody who's currently in the program can continue to renew their work authorization through DACA. And it looks like even those who weren't able to apply previously, perhaps because they were too young, even though they otherwise qualified when the program was announced, should be able to apply at this point. So it's a huge ruling for justice for these young people to be allowed to remain in this country and continue to contribute.
But I think, as a lot of people are commenting in the aftermath of the release of this decision, this seems to be a temporary reprieve for DACA recipients, not necessarily the final word. How do you see it? Is DACA here to stay, or is this just a reprieve?
Well, it certainly is a reminder that the only real permanent solution would be congressional action to provide permanent status and a path to citizenship for DACA holders for these young people. And I certainly hope that this will inspire more movement in that direction. It is true that the ruling basically says that the way the administration went around terminating the program was what was problematic, and so they could try again. They may not. It's politically risky at this point near an election, and maybe not even time-wise possible to go about terminating the program again. But that is possible. But for the time being, the program is back in place as it was in 2012 when the Obama administration announced it.
But as I understand it, this isn't even the end of the cases which ultimately arrived at the Supreme Court's doorstep, right? Those are going to be remanded to the lower courts.
That's right. And that's quite usual in a ruling like this one. There are always additional questions to be asked and the like. But the justices, Chief Justice Roberts in particular, put a pretty heavy hand on the scale of saying that the justifications that the administration provided for this in terminating the program were really pretty suspect, and the administration just hadn't done its homework, hadn't really provided explanation of what it was doing, and certainly hadn't taken into account issues like the level of reliance that people have had on the program. So yes, the program is back in place. The cases will be remanded back to the lower courts, and the administration can try to do a better job of explaining why it wishes to terminate after taking into account all the factors. But that's likely to take months, if not years, to work itself out.
to be specific, the court said that the Trump administration was arbitrary and capricious, which means what exactly?
It means that there are certain rules about how you start or end programs, big federal programs that affect, as you say, hundreds of thousands of people. You can't just on a whim as a new administration say, I don't like it anymore. We're going to end that. You have to consider a range of factors, provide careful justification, weigh pros and cons, and then make a decision. And here the administration, frankly, was just more arrogant than that. They just wanted to end the program without really explaining it.
What about new DACA recipients? It's estimated in Texas there may be as many as 192,000 people eligible for this program as it stands. Does this mean the program can start admitting new recipients?
Well, as I say, it looks as though, at least during this window, and things may change again, that there will be a space for people to apply who've never applied before. That's going to be huge, for example, for students at Texas universities, because we're now reaching a point where there were people who otherwise qualified back in 2012 when the program was announced or before the Trump administration terminated it, but who were too young to apply. And so they're now entering college, and now they may be able to apply for DACA. And with all the benefits that that brings in terms of being able to help pay their way through college by working and otherwise integrating into the community even more fully.
Now, Attorney General Ken Paxton gave this statement after the Supreme Court ruling, and I want to quote him here. "We are disappointed with today's SCOTUS decision, but it does not resolve the underlying issue that President Obama's original executive order exceeded his constitutional authority. We look forward to continuing litigating that issue in our case now pending in the Southern District of Texas." As you see it, does this still leave open the question of whether President Obama had the power to implement the program in the first place?
It does leave that question open. It doesn't really take it on. But again, there are some comments in the opinion that are pretty relevant around the fact that basically what this program was just an exercise of prosecutorial discretion. Like every enforcement entity in the entire country, including police, the Department of Justice, you don't go after every single case, including for immigration, detention, and deportation. Mm-hmm. And so basically what DACA was a statement that we're not going to go after people who meet these certain criteria and tried to make that prosecutorial discretion more transparent and more systematic. And there's a suggestion that that may actually be just fine, which is what legal scholars have been saying for many, many years.
Denise Gilman directs the Immigration Clinic at the University of Texas Law School. Professor, thank you.
Thank you very much.
For more reaction on the DACA ruling by the Supreme Court, we're joined by Antonio Arellano in Houston. He is a DACA recipient and the interim executive director of Jolt Action, which is a progressive organization in Texas focused on empowering Latino voters. Mr. Arellano, thanks for joining us. What's your reaction to the court's ruling?
Thank you for having me. Today's Supreme Court ruling is a historic victory for immigrant youth across the United States that have been targeted and terrorized for the past 3 years under this current administration. But it really reaffirms what we already know, which is DACA recipients make America stronger, and they deserve to live and thrive in the country that we call home. For the last couple of years, we have seen these attacks on our community, and what the Supreme Court said today is that DACA recipients matter and that their contributions should be upheld.
As a DACA recipient yourself, what now? I mean, how does this decision affect you, your life, and as you see it, others in the program, as a practical matter?
You know, Texas is home to the second largest population of DACA beneficiaries in the United States. And it's imperative that we recognize that this fight is not over. And as a matter of fact, this fight is in our backyard, right here in the Lone Star State. We are renewing our call to Congress to make sure that they find the courage to finally provide a permanent solution to our nation's broken immigration system. We need immigration reform that includes a pathway to citizenship for all undocumented immigrants.
Mr. Arellano, I want to hear a little bit more about your personal story. How has your status as a DACA recipient affected your life, and does this news change any of it?
Absolutely. You know, it's a great sigh of relief this morning, but it's only a temporary relief for the next 2 years. As a DACA recipient, DACA has provided me with an opportunity to get a secondary education, to be able to work, to be able to contribute to the nation that I've called home since the age of 3. DACA recipients in America are as American as apple pie. We've grown up with the Pledge of Allegiance. We've grown up with the Star Spangled Banner. We recognize and want to contribute to the greatness of this nation. It's imperative that other Texans and Americans start to recognize that we can't continue to undermine the contributions that DACA recipients make to our state. So many of us are contributing right now in the medical field and protecting American lives against COVID-19. The contributions economically are also so significant. DACA recipients and DACA eligible individuals paid an estimated $244 million in state and local taxes in 2018 alone. We are a crucial part of this community, and it's imperative that people in the state, in this country, start to recognize and value our existence just as much as anybody else's.
How do you feel about the court's decision to remand these cases back to the lower courts? They could have decided these if they so chose, but instead they came up with some parameters for the lower courts to consider. What do you make of the Supreme Court's posture?
So two things. One, we need to recognize the opportunity that exists right now, and we need to make sure that we encourage anybody who's eligible for DACA to apply or renew. It's imperative that we get the protections that these people need during this window of time that we have. Secondly, the stance that the Supreme Court took could have been a little bit more clear and more stern against the Trump administration, but we're not surprised because we've seen the Supreme Court uphold the Trump administration's Muslim ban and other recent immigration proposals that they have submitted to the court. What we do know is that the undocumented community is resilient and that we are growing in numbers and in power in this country, and that we are living in a moment where we can no longer be paralyzed by fear. It's imperative that we continue to share our stories to make sure that the human aspect of the contributions that undocumented immigrants make to our community are valued, recognized, and appreciated.
Antonio Arellano is a DACA recipient, and he is interim executive director of JOLT Action in Texas, a progressive organization focused on empowering Latino voters. Mr. Arellano, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's bring in Wells Dunbar. He is our social media editor. I'm sure you're hearing a lot from listeners right now, Wells.
Indeed, David. Hearing from several listeners about the DACA ruling from the Supreme Court. Via Facebook, Jose Fonseca calls it a battle won in the ongoing war for immigration reform. It seems more and more that the judicial system is able to rebuke Mr. Trump's assault on our systems of governances, he writes. And John Michael Tullis says SCOTUS is on fire this week, referring to that previous decision from the Supreme Court establishing transgender employees' rights in the workplace. John Davis, he takes some issue with the legal rationale for overruling the Trump administration, citing the Chief Justice's own words that the administration failed to provide a, quote, reasoned explanation for its action. He asked, how reasoned an explanation can one give for punishing a child for the sins of the father? Just some of the reactions we're seeing, David. I'll be back with more later.
Indeed, we need to hear from you. Tweet us at Texas Standard.
Hey, this is Walker Lukens, co-host of Song Confessional, the only podcast where today's top songwriters turn your anonymous stories into original songs. Part two of our two-part episode featuring LA's Pigeon John is out now. Listen to my interview with Pigeon John to learn more about his influences and how he got so dang prolific. If you haven't heard part one, go back and check it out now. Listen to Song Confessional at KETX.org or wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The pandemic has hit public education hard, so far eliminating 500,000 jobs in the U.S. In Texas, many school leaders are scraping by for this budget cycle, but they're worried about next year. Houston Public Media's Laura Eisensee brings us some lessons from 2011, the last time Texas schools found themselves in the crosshairs of a recession.
Back then, Texas lawmakers faced a massive gap in the state budget, so they looked to cut areas like education.
Save our schools!
Protect our teachers!
In response, thousands marched in Austin. Teachers, students, and parents begged the legislature to spare school spending. Instead, lawmakers slashed $5 billion in state aid to public schools, the biggest cuts to education since World War II. In Southwest Houston, H.D. Chambers was just starting his job as superintendent of A-Leaf schools.
We all begin kind of trying to dig ourselves out of this, in my case, $30 to $35 million hole over the next several years.
He didn't lay off teachers, but left other positions vacant, like school staff who engaged with families.
So it'd be like asking you to cover three elementary schools and work with each group of families on each one of those three schools. That was a mistake.
Chambers calls it a lesson in unintended consequences. While those staff members didn't work directly in the classroom, their work with parents had an impact on students' performance.
As fast as I could, I was trying to correct not only a issue that by cutting that created a problem, but I was also trying to correct it because it was actually a potential solution to our ultimate goal of educating children.
Now, because of COVID-19, Texas is staring down a long and hard recession. Many educators and experts hope the state doesn't repeat the same mistakes with the budget.
I know history tends to repeat itself.
Chandra Villanueva is with Every Texan, a policy group focused on social justice.
I'm like getting so much deja vu. It's always like back in 2011, like I've been here before.
That year was the first time she advocated in Austin. Since then, Villanueva has studied how those $5 billion in cuts to education affected students campus by campus.
What we found was that it was our lowest income students and English language learners in our campuses with the highest concentrations of low income students that were hit the hardest.
Take the A-Leaf School District again. More than 80% of its students are economically disadvantaged. More than 40% are learning English. And those family engagement staff members who were cut, they primarily served those students, helping many immigrant families connect to the U.S. education system for the first time. Darlene Bro says it's important lawmakers remember schools provide social supports.
Those types of services that impacted our students and their families.
Bro was a principal back then and now serves on A-Leaf school board.
We tend to forget that it's a rippling effect. What's going on in the community impacts the households. What happens in the households impacts the student. What happens with the student impacts the classroom.
The final lesson from 2011 is once deep cuts are made, it's really hard to get the money back. As A-Leaf Superintendent H.D. Chambers says,
we need to be reminded that it took us a decade to recover from what happened in 2011.
Those cuts launched the state's biggest ever lawsuit over school finance. Eventually, in 2019, lawmakers gave $6.5 billion back to schools. But state leaders passed that new funding without exactly knowing how they'd pay for it and not expecting a global pandemic, which means this time around, Texas's looming budget crunch could be even tighter. In Houston, I'm Laura Eisensee.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Doctors now have a new way to help kids with ADHD, a prescription video game. The FDA has approved the game for kids ages 8 to 12 who experience attention deficits. It's the first time the agency has approved a game for prescription use. Our tech expert Omar Gayaga is here to tell us about this game and about some other ways that people are finding games to be therapeutic, especially when it comes to maintaining good mental and emotional health these days. Hello there, Omar.
Hey, David. Thanks for having me.
This sounds rather revolutionary, a prescription video game. Tell us about it.
Yeah, this is from a company called Akili Interactive based out of Boston, and the game itself is called Endeavor RX, and it is meant, as you said, to help kids between the ages of 8 and 12 who struggle with ADHD. And the game itself involves dodging obstacles, collecting targets, going through these kind of landscapes with ice and lava, and really the focus of it is to stimulate the neural systems that are necessary for attention function. So this is the first game we've ever seen with FDA approval that can be prescribed, but you know, this has been in the works for quite a while.
It's interesting, your description of it makes it sound like a lot of video games I feel like I've seen over the years. How did the game developer go about proving to the FDA that this game can actually help kids?
Well, you know, we usually hear about these long development cycles for games like, you know, Legend of Zelda, Breath of the Wild, or, you know, all of Rockstar's Grand Theft Auto games. They take, you know, 10 years to make. This took seven, you know, for this game that, you know, looks very simple, but I mean, it was 7 years of clinical trials. But we should note that these were clinical trials done by doctors paid by this company. So this was not, you know, external research. But they examined over 600 kids with this game, and they found that there was a 30% improvement among some of those kids. So, you know, it took a lot of studies and a long time to develop this game.
Wow. So this is the first prescription video game, but as I gather, it's not the only one that claims to be beneficial for some players. Tell us a little bit more about the concept of therapeutic gaming. Who are these games for, and how can they help?
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk about that over the years, more probably in the last 10 years. But, you know, back in the day, it was, oh, hand-eye coordination. That is the number one benefit of video games.
Yeah, right.
But over time, we've seen that, you know, games like Tetris can help relax people and reduce PTSD. There have been studies about increased attention. There's cognitive functioning. And, you know, we've seen this kind of movement in the last few years toward, you know, VR being used to teach empathy, you know, kind of narratives and kind of getting into someone else's shoes to kind of see their point of view. That is one of the big you know, proponent arguments for VR. So yeah, we're seeing a lot of games that, you know, studies around, can games help people cope with, you know, depression, with anxiety, things like that.
Interesting, because I think there are a lot of people listening who are looking for ways to support their own mental health. And you, in fact, have found a lot of interesting apps out there. Tell us a little bit more about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people use video games as a distraction, as a coping mechanism. You know, during the pandemic, we've had a lot of people staying at home, and they're playing video games to kind of pass the time. But we also are seeing things like, you know, meditation VR apps, kind of blocking out the world and going into this virtual VR place that is relaxing and beautiful, and audios, you know, stimulating your brain. There's one app that was developed in Austin that I've been keeping an eye on, called Sound Self, that uses kind of psychedelic visuals and sound to kind of meditate you and put you into a trance-like state. So there's a lot of movement, especially in VR, to kind of try to figure out, like, can these be used in therapeutic ways?
Some games, I gather, are also supposed to support brain health. Do you have any favorite brain games, Smarty Pants?
I play a lot of strategy games. I mean, I like Ticket to Ride. You know, that's a very famous board game, that, and there's a video game version of it for, you know, iPad and PC. I play that a lot, and that gets my brain stimulated. I like the old Brain Age game. I don't know if you remember that. That was an old Nintendo
Brain
DS
Age.
Game. Uh-huh. Yeah, and it was meant to, like, all these puzzles that were meant to kind of keep your brain age young, like keep your brain from aging. So I liked a lot of those. It was a lot of Sudoku and things like that.
Well, dear listener, you can tap into Omar Gayaga's brain over at TechMinuteTexas.com anytime you'd like. Good to have you back on the broadcast, Omar. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, David. Talk to you next week.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The U.S. House will consider legislation mandating sweeping changes to policing next week after the Judiciary Committee voted Wednesday to advance the Democratic-backed bill. It would ban chokeholds and make it easier to prosecute officers for misconduct by modifying qualified immunity. East Texas Republican Louis Gohmert sits on the Congressional Committee. He spoke out against terminating the legal protection for officers.
There are bad cops. There are some racists, but let the good cops help us get rid of it. Don't get rid of qualified immunity till we know the effect, and I yield back.
Senate Republicans will debate their own policing bill next week. As COVID-19 cases in Texas climb, one of the communities seeing a spike is Galveston County. Local health authority Dr. Philip Kaiser says a third of the county's more than 1,400 cases have been reported since June 1st.
We all expected to see more cases. What I think has everybody concerned is how rapidly they're increasing. And so we are in a scenario where literally within a couple of weeks we could see some of the hospitals overwhelmed.
Kaiser says the sudden increase in cases is due to people not socially distancing or wearing face masks. U.S. Senator Ted Cruz is criticizing the Federal Aviation Administration's slow response to the deadly Boeing 737 MAX airliner crashes in 2018 and 2019. During a Senate hearing yesterday, the Texas Republican accused FAA Chief Steve Dixon of failing to fire or discipline anyone for approving a faulty flight control system that led to 346 deaths in Ethiopia and Indonesia.
You understand, sir, you do not work for the airlines and you do not work for Boeing. You work for the American people.
Dixon said the FAA has revamped its review processes for certifying aircraft. And University of Texas at Austin researchers have identified what they believe is the egg of a giant marine reptile that swam in the warm waters of Antarctica 68 million years ago. The team analyzed tissue samples of the soft-shelled egg first discovered in 2011 and determined it was possibly laid by a mosasaur or plesiosaur. UT Austin paleontologist Lucas Legendre co-authored the findings published in the science journal Nature.
It looks basically like a big giant food. It's about the same size as a football, American football, and has this kind of very wavy, deflated aspect with a bit like the egg of a lizard or a snake.
Legendre says the large opening on the fossilized egg is likely where a reptile hatched. I'm Joseph Leahy.
As communities grapple with the coronavirus pandemic, new developments unfold continuously. Catch up on the day's news from around the world and across Texas by listening to All Things Considered. Weekday afternoons on your local NPR station.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. On June 18th, 1865, over 250,000 black slaves still lived in bondage in Texas. Legally speaking, they'd been free for over 2.5 years. Legally speaking, but not in practice. President Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation wasn't enforceable all the way out in Texas. That would change the next day, though, June the 19th. The Civil War was over, and a Union general named Gordon Granger had recently landed in Galveston to begin a federal occupation of Texas. He began by issuing a series of orders, among them that all slaves were to be freed. Though total emancipation would take even longer, the day that came to be known as Juneteenth was nonetheless a line of demarcation, a day to celebrate and to remember. So writes Michael Hurd in a recent essay for Texas Highways magazine. He's the director of the Texas Institute for the Preservation of History and Culture at Prairie View A&M University. Professor, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much, David.
You begin this essay by writing about what you remember about the Juneteenth celebrations you attended as a child. Share some of those memories with us here, if you don't mind.
Well, growing up in Southeast Houston, my family would go on this, we called it a picnic, out to this farm, actually near Prairie View, and spend the day celebrating with our friends and our parents' friends, you know, just having a feast of all kinds of wonderful soul food and us kids running around and playing games. And we never really knew, as children, we never really got the significance, you know, fully of what that day was, but just that it was a wonderful day to be with our friends.
Why do you think that you didn't fully understand its significance until later in life?
Well, we really didn't get a lot of black history in high school, you know, back in the day, back in the 60s, you know, and so we really didn't have the understanding of a lot of what black culture was about and that sort of thing. You know, we knew there were certain things you did, but we didn't always have a grasp of the understanding, you know, so we didn't get taught that in high school. And we really didn't have a lot of conversations as a family back then about those kinds of legacies and histories and things that we should be aware of. So there was just, you know, a lack of conversation back then.
Well, what was the process by which you came to better understand Juneteenth as an adult?
Well, for me, it was self-education. And a lot of what I got came from black publications, black newspapers and magazines like Ebony and Jet magazines, the Houston Forward Time newspaper, the Houston Informer, the Chicago Defender, and so forth. They would have these little factoids, you know, these like, do you know? And it would highlight people and events throughout Black history. And for me, as I started to research Black history, I kept coming across all of these, you know, why don't I know this moment? You know, I had a lot of those. And so it was just my self-educating myself about Black history and what Juneteenth really meant.
Yeah. Well, now part of your story discusses how Juneteenth itself has changed over time. I mean, from a pure celebration to a kind of a launching pad for political ambitions from time to time to something with perhaps a more commercial feel. I wonder, do you see the day itself as having changed for you at all with time and perspective?
Not really for me. You know, I would say as a child, you know, we just went to this big picnic. But as an adult, you know, I would go to, I would attend programs and festivals and you know, there would be, you know, job fairs, you know, there would be parades and marches and that sort of thing. So as it took on more of a community-wide, you know, festival, you know, I would participate in that regard. So, and the celebrations have gotten a lot more diverse, and I'm really happy to see that.
Well, may I ask how you plan to spend it?
Well, right now I don't have any plans, you know, so I'm thinking it's going to be kind of a quiet day, but, you know, every Juneteenth I do take some time to reflect on what that day means and what it must have been like to be told, you know, after all you've gone through as a slave, to be told that you are free, you know, and how exhilarating that feeling had to be. And so I'm sure part of my day will be spent in reflection.
Michael Hurd is the director of the Texas Institute for the Preservation of History and Culture at Prairie View A&M University. We'll have a link to his Texas Highways magazine essay on Juneteenth at texasstandard.org. Professor, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
You know, I wonder how many people know that Juneteenth was made a state holiday in Texas, and Texas was the first state to do so. We'd love to hear how you plan on marking Juneteenth. Reach out to us on social media. Wells Dunbar will have more of your comments in 35 minutes.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Tech University's online school program, TTU K-12, offering fully online courses for kindergarten through 12th grade to start anytime from anywhere. Learn more by searching TTU K-12.
The first episode of Season 5 of Pause Play is out now. This season is all about change. Climate change, changes in laws, changes in ticketing. How are these things impacting Austin music? In this episode, we look at how COVID changed how we feel about live music. Plus, we do an overview of Season 1. You can find Pause Play on KUT.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The uncertainty of the times we're living in has many looking into the past for lessons, and some of us would have loved the opportunity to ask members of what's been called the greatest generation how they managed to survive and eventually thrive. You know, many millennials are wondering how their own parents overcame struggle, and one of them, Joshua Diaz in Austin, recently sat down with his father while they still have each other.
During this coronavirus crisis, I felt that I needed some wisdom on how to successfully navigate setbacks. And I figured, why wait until we're old men to have this conversation?
Hello, my name is Derek Diaz. I'm a residential home builder and developer in Austin, Texas. I'd like to first start by telling you how I entered into my business career. About 18 years old, out of high school, I started an import-export business, mostly miscellaneous items like garbage cans, computer goods, printed paper goods, mostly with Mexico. Found some pretty good success doing that. But at that age, it seemed far too easy.
Eager for a real challenge, my dad turned to building homes.
I had an acquaintance that I knew in high school that was building houses with his father, and found that I liked the business, and I felt that I could stay in the business whether or not things worked out between us.
Things didn't turn out well between them. His business partner ran out of money and left during their first project. my dad went on to build over 30 homes with no prior experience.
I started to become a developer. I worked on a project in the city of Utica in Michigan for about 8 years. It was a really big project. It was about about $150 million project.
As soon as the project was underway, the economy soured. Remember this address from President George W. Bush?
As uncertainty has grown, many banks have restricted lending, and families and businesses have found it harder to borrow money. We are in the midst of a serious financial crisis.
One day I was waiting for a draw from the bank. Week goes by, 2 weeks goes by, 3 weeks goes by. Finally, the president of the bank called me up and said, you know, we're going out of business. So that project pretty much died on the vine.
The crisis left him financially and psychologically in despair.
The next step in life was figure out how to feed a family.
He packed up my mom, my sister, and me, and we all moved to Texas.
I was offered to come to Beaumont, Texas, to my brother's house, actually, to build a restaurant for my brother and a professional baseball player at the time. But the professional baseball player, who it was named after, got into financial trouble.
The baseball player had no money to put in, and when word got out, the other investors pulled out too.
And it quickly became as bad or worse than what I left in Michigan. I went on unemployment twice while I worked there just so that we could eat.
He was still broke, and with the banks still not lending money after the Great Recession, he turned to the restaurant's investors for money to fund his real estate venture. To make a long story short, his partners once again didn't hold their end of the deal to invest, and a year-long lawsuit ensued. My father ended up with the land for his newest project. But life still isn't done throwing hurdles in the way of my dad's big plans. But this time, he feels ready.
Had a minor setback here, I believe, with COVID-19. But I think I have the arrows in my quiver to understand it. Stay calm. Keep moving. The lessons are knowing that nothing lasts. You know, the sun comes out tomorrow regardless.
What I have learned is that my dad is tenacious, and that everything he does is for me and my family, and we love him for that. Happy Father's Day. I'm Joshua Diaz in Austin, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
It's Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. The forced closure of schools because of the pandemic hit homeless kids who depend on school for meals especially hard. KERA's Bill Zeeble checked in with some homeless students and an organization that's trying to help.
It's a typical Wednesday at the Incarnation House, which is designed to help homeless high school students at North Dallas High across the street. All the typical routines, though, have changed.
Technically speaking, we're an after-school program. However, we all came back from spring break with a whole new world.
Evelyn Costello runs the nonprofit Incarnation House. During the school year, the program feeds and teaches kids before and after class, kids whose parents lack a permanent address. This summer, though, they've never really closed.
So we created this pantry program, and we have been doing at-home deliveries on a weekly basis so that that was not a worry in the home.
All that paper rustling, our bags getting filled with fresh and canned food, destined for those who use Incarnation House. 17-year-old Bertadria Promise, newly minted North Dallas High graduate, welcomes the truck deliveries. She stands outside the apartment where she lives with her mom and her aunt.
I just feel like it's a blessing to have food and other people around us to help us during the pandemic.
One of those people who's around is Brian Jackson, who provides full-time security for Incarnation House. After a few years on the job, he got to know all the students, so he was a natural fit to deliver the food.
Some of the areas that we go to are really bad and wouldn't want like any of the ladies to deliver there because it's not really the best of neighborhoods to be in.
Jackson knows these deliveries help keep students and relatives from going hungry.
A lot of them, the only time they will eat a fresh meal, hot meal, is if it's here or at school. Well, if there's no school, they're already missing out on that meal.
about 25 families a week get food deliveries from Incarnation House. On this particular day, a family showed up in person. Sophia Silbus lives in the nearby Budget Motel with her 17-year-old son and 12-year-old daughter, and she works at an elder care facility.
My son attends the Incarnation House after school, and they've been helping us a lot since the school has ended. Resources, food, clothing.
Living in a motel qualifies the family as homeless. Though they're struggling financially, Silbus risks her life every day working at the elder care facility.
We actually have two full hallways of COVID-19 positive patients. I have six staff members that tested positive. Thankfully, I am not one of them. We did have a staff member pass away. We have residents pass on a regular basis.
Silbus has her own high-risk medical conditions, including heart disease and a previous stroke. Changing jobs in the middle of a pandemic is out of the question. The Incarnation House has offered stability for her and her kids, including son Kevin Crockett. He just finished his junior year.
It's been a really cool place for me to hang out, and they feed me, give me a ride home after practice, get to hang with all my friends.
Kevin says this place also helped settle him down after the family moved into the motel and his mother got sick. Incarnation House Chair Diane LaRose says staffers learned early that these kids needed more than breakfast once a week, which is how it all started years ago.
We would feed them, you know, breakfast, and we got to know them. We'd sit down at tables with them and chat and find out what their needs were. We discovered they don't just need food. They need all kinds of things. So, you know, we started evolving and developing, and I could never turn my back on those kids again.
School may be out for the summer, but no one knows what classes will look like this fall. LaRose says even though she's not sure what'll happen next for kids this organization serves, she figures Incarnation House and its students will keep evolving. I'm Bill Zeeble in Dallas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, welcoming visitors back to the historic beach town with downtown shopping, Gulf seafood, and family attractions such as Moody Gardens, the Bryan Museum, and more. Details at galveston.com.
You're tuned to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Next month, Texans who get unemployment payments will have to prove they tried to get a job if they want to continue receiving payments. The Texas Workforce Commission suspended the work search requirement because of the coronavirus pandemic, but now that more businesses have reopened, the state plans to restore the work search provision on July 6th. Here to tell us more about the overall unemployment picture in Texas and these changes, Ed Cerna. He is the executive director of the Texas Workforce Commission. Ed, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get to the reinstated work search requirement, have unemployment claims remained on the rise, or what have you been seeing?
We are seeing them decline. There are still individuals that are reaching out to us for first-time benefits, or initial claims as we call them, but none of them dating back all the way to March and April and May. These are individuals whose businesses, or who were working for businesses that hung on as long as they could, and they've now recently been furloughed or had their hours reduced.
I see.
So we are seeing downward trends, but there are still individuals that need help from us.
Now, it's my understanding that April saw an unemployment rate of 12% in Texas. Put that on a mental plot graph, if you will. Remind me of the average number of claims filed last year, for example.
Last year, we probably didn't break 500,000, and we did all of the equivalent of last year sometime in the month of March.
Wow.
I get a report every morning, and as of yesterday, we had 3.2 million claims filed, and we had paid out in excess of $12 billion. So it's a lot of money and a lot of individuals that we're helping, and we're glad to, and there's more that need our help, and we're going to do that too.
$12 billion, though, is a huge sum. I mean, if you put it in the context of, say, the so-called rainy day fund, which is at least $2 billion less, where's this money coming from?
The majority of the money that we're using, that $12.9 billion, is coming from the federal government as a result of the CARES Act. Of course, we expended everything in our trust fund here a couple of days ago. We went longer than we had originally anticipated. We thought we were going to run out of fund in May and actually went all the way into early June. Now, that doesn't affect any of the claims at all because we had already made arrangements to secure what are called Title 12 loans. And these are interest-free to the end of the year. We're hoping that the government goes interest-free for a longer period of time. They're called loans, but they're basically a line of credit. As we need funds to pay unemployment insurance claims, if our trust fund is at zero, then we get deposits into our trust fund that cover that day's expenditures. And so far, we've taken in about 240 plus million in the past about 5 days in Title 12 funds.
As I'm sure you've heard, as we've been reporting quite a bit on the Standard, the COVID-19 numbers are rather alarming, not just an increase in hospitalizations, but an increase in the number of cases to new historic highs. Some people may think, well, wait a minute, is this the time to bring back the work search requirement that was suspended for COVID-19? What would you say to them?
The challenge that we face together, we, the Workforce Commission, and all the employers and the job seekers or employees, is how to do that safely and how to make sure that the individuals who have an issue, a valid issue with being able to return to work, still get the benefits that they need, but at the same time that we encourage individuals that can return to work safely, return to work so that we can get the economy started again. If you're over the age of 65 or at high risk from a health perspective, mm-hmm. as described by Department of State Health Services, or you have someone in a household, in your household like that, of course, if you've been diagnosed with COVID-19 or someone in your household, if you're quarantined, or if you're having childcare issues, and that's still a potential issue is childcare, then those are valid reasons for turning down a suitable offer for employment without having your benefits, unemployment insurance benefits or pandemic unemployment assistance jeopardized.
Do you still have to show that you've been seeking employment nonetheless, or what exactly?
Yes, sir, but that should be a relatively simple task. So it's not requiring people to go out in public and go knock on doors and drop off resumes or have interviews or even, quite frankly, make phone calls. It's simply a matter of, did you log into work in Texas and look at the jobs that were out there? Were you searching for work?
Ed Cerna is the executive director of the Texas Workforce Commission. Ed, thanks so much for spending some time with us on the Texas Standard. We certainly do appreciate the update.
Absolute pleasure. Anytime you'd like, I'd be glad to.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard.
Wells Dunbar is monitoring the Talk of Texas as our social media editor. Wells, I will imagine I know what most folks are talking about today.
Yeah, that big DACA ruling from the Supreme Court allowing the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals plan implemented under the Obama administration to stand for now. Lots of folks continuing to sound off about this one via Facebook. Tim notes that this is a good day for the dreamers and gives stability to young people who love and are building the future of this country. Many of our friends and listeners in favor of the ruling from the high court today, but there are some countervailing perspectives. David Noble calls it absolute nonsense on several levels, the court's ruling. He adds, I hope Trump takes this precedent and uses an executive memo, as Obama did in establishing DACA, to do anything he likes. So obviously they're a opposite opinion to lots of those that we have been receiving about this ruling. Big, big decision, and hard to overstate the impact of the decision here in Texas. And I think, as y'all were describing earlier in the program, one that is going to take quite some time to sort of work its way through the court process. Not the last we've heard of this, but definitely a respite for those people in the country who were relying on those DACA protections. Mm-hmm. Well, in the midst of a coronavirus spike, a little bit of a different story here. Governor Greg Abbott has conceded that local officials can, in fact, mandate masks as long as it's businesses making and enforcing those rules, not the government imposing the rule on citizens itself. Interesting development here in our ongoing health pandemic. This came after Bexar County Judge Nelson Wolf, who I believe appeared on the program earlier this week.
He did. Yes, he did.
He announced businesses must have a health and safety requirement rules in place, including face mask requirements or face steep fines. So asked about this decision, Governor Abbott said the county had, quote, finally figured out how to interpret his ruling, adding that, quote, they've always had the opportunity and the ability to do this. Quote, now local officials are just now realizing that that was authorized. So many people taking some sort of exception here with the governor's remarks, saying that this was a sort of, it's puzzling that he sort of presented his rule here as something to be creatively parsed and prodded by local officials.
I think the point that the governor was making was that his rule affected individuals and not businesses, and that mm-hmm. Judge Wolf's order went to businesses.
Yeah. Still, people sort of upset, though, I think you could say, with the way that this was presented mm-hmm. and then the fact that it wasn't made more obvious. One representative tweet here from Jordan Vondi tweets us that was this a scavenger hunt or a riddle, or are people just now realizing this is a possibility because Governor Abbott never mentioned this option? Other people calling the decision deceitful at best, negligent at worst. All that said, communities moving forward, new plans. Bexar County, Hidalgo County, Travis County, all slated to put these mask orders in place in at businesses.
You know, you can keep up with the news 24/7 over at TexasStandard.org. We're out of time for the broadcast today, but we'll be back here tomorrow, and we hope you'll join us.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.
Do brain games really make me smarter? What is all this screen time doing to my brain? How do I protect my brain as I age? Find the answers to life's most and least pressing questions about your mind with the Two Guys on Your Head podcast. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts.